This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, The Greatest Liars: What Acting Can Teach Writers About Creating Characters.
And this week was a shout out to Taylor, who was the one who suggested this week's episode again.
Thank you to Taylor Denwood. And basically, we're tackling this probably from an angle that maybe you didn't anticipate, but we promise it's going to be a good one.
Definitely. And it's also definitely a subject that actually both of us have been thinking about quite recently. So hopefully everybody's going to enjoy it as well as much as we are.
Yes.
So,
there we go. In my case, it's, again, outing myself as a nerd, I genuinely clearly think that there's nothing you can't learn from reading a book, but I've been reading a book about points with acting and things, just because, okay, I am finally going to do the unveiled audiobooks.
Sorry, that came out really loud.
It's like, I think only the dogs and bats that listen to us can actually hear you on that one now, Madeline.
Oh, that was a genuine squeak of excitement, because this is the first I'm hearing of this, so I'm super pumped now.
So yeah, people keep asking me, when are they going to happen? The reason there's been a bit of a delay is A, I needed to update some kit, and B, I needed time in order to start doing it and planning it properly, because if I'm going to do it, I'm not going to do a half-assed job. And C, except for the ones that come very specifically from, say, Kieran or Lucas's point of view later in the series, I'm probably narrating my own books. So I feel relatively confident about this, but also at the same time, I'm like, yeah, why not read a book about acting to brush up a few things about making sure the character voices sound okay? I'm not a great actor, but I'm not a terrible voice performance person either.
I think you're really good.
I have to say, there is a note here, though. It's like, and this note is basically, Ironside, stop writing accents for your characters when you're going to be the person performing them. And it's like, we'll talk about getting into character and stuff later, but I'm like, why did I write all these accents? Why are they all so, why do they all sound so different? They all have such different syntax. And now I've got to deal with that. So that's going to be fun. But anyway, reading this book and obviously Taylor's question about creating deep characterization made me think, wow, there's an awful lot of crossover between acting and writing.
Yeah.
And there's three particular quotes. One of them, I can't think who to attribute it to, but it's one I read very early in my writing career where someone said, writers are the ugly actors, which is way, way harsh. But also it's kind of like, I can kind of see your point there as well, because the way we engage with characters is very similar. It's just we're not necessarily meant to tread the boards or be behind a camera.
Yeah.
In front of a camera, rather. Two other quotes. This is sort of more of a paraphrase. This is Thomas Hardy, but he was actually right on this. And it's basically, the most complicated character on page is a thin, pale version compared to the simplest man off the street. So,
yeah.
You know, even the people you think are really straightforward are actually very complicated and have many, many motives and many layers of character themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're actually going to go into why that is and some of the ways that you can think about that in a little bit. But yeah, I heartily agree. Human beings are incredibly complex.
A final quote, and this is one for bearing in mind as we go through stuff. And this is Stanislavski, who was a great method actor. Method acting, basically, you put yourself in the position of giving yourself the experience of what you're going to, or what your character's going to be doing. He said, love the art in yourself, not yourself in the art. So I think it's his way of saying, depersonify yourself, but draw on your own experiences, if you like.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but Madeline also has been, you know, because Madeline and I live parallel lives for some reason, Madeline's also been engaging with this topic from a slightly different direction.
Yeah, so I've actually been teaching about method writing as part of one of my courses. And method writing is one of those things which is, it's a relatively new term in so much that you don't hear it that often, but it is essentially the same as method acting. And it's basically about using tools and stuff like that to actually kind of become your character or to share your character's experiences.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And we'll kind of go a little bit into that in a little bit, because we've actually got quite a lot to cover. So.
We have. Anyway, creating characters in writing and in acting is a very similar process now that we're looking at it. And you can learn, you know, probably actors and writers can learn a lot from each other. And certainly that must be the case for people who sort of direct and produce and write screenplays.
Mm.
Because you must be able to envisage how someone is about to say your lines or what they can bring to it.
Yeah.
There's the two main types of actor. Representational. Mm-hmm. A representational actor imitates or illustrates what a character would feel or portray. So they're mimics, if you like.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's also not necessarily deep characterization. And you find probably quite a lot of the comedic actors who are doing fairly light but often quite intelligent roles do the imitation illustration thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, it can work perfectly well. But I have seen, and again, I'm not a great judge necessarily, but I have seen actors come a cropper doing it this way rather than really thinking themselves into the part.
Yeah.
Then there's presentational. The presentational actor attempts to basically become the character by using parts of themselves. So as Madeline mentioned in a previous episode, a good actor always brings something of themselves to the role. So it's them, yeah, but also them as they would be if their life had taken these turns, these various selection pressures, what have you, if they'd had that sort of upbringing. And that's where you get great casting directors who are really good at picking the right person for the right role, because they can see an actor's potential, but also what they themselves would bring to the role rather than just merely imitating it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is, as I've said in the previous episode, acting and writing, there is this kind of this split at that point, because the moment you require something that has acting in it is the moment that there is a combination of thought and a combination of ideas, which can in some ways really help to create an even more nuanced character. Because as Jill said right at the beginning, that Hardy quote, you really, really do have the person on the street is ultimately more complex than anyone who's on the page. But the moment that you can have two people sort of working on one thing together, you come out with a more nuanced and more complex character. So in some ways, acting kind of has the benefit of that. Whereas writing can be even harder, I think, and can therefore requires a lot of attention, and if it's done right, it can be sensational. But if it isn't quite done right, you can end up with a character who feels quite flat.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's like being told that you can only work in two dimensions, but it must look as though you've actually worked in three.
Yeah.
So we're going to look at some of the things you might like to consider when you are building your character. Now, we can't stress this enough, as we said with actors, you know, the presentational actor, which honestly I think I prefer generally, particularly if it's a serious film or a very thinky film. I want to see a presentational actor. I don't want to see someone sort of mimicking it or coming in light and not really understanding the character.
Mm-hmm.
When you're a writer and creating characters, every single character, from your villain down to the kitchen maid who is in one third of a scene, has come from you, as in they are parts of your personality. They're tiny little seed personalities that you have grown, and you might have spliced on bits that you've found in other people's personalities or quirks and things you've noticed.
Yeah.
But largely, they are you. This is your sock puppet theatre, and how well you do the voices will convince your readers to keep reading or not.
Yes. And actually, I think it's worth saying that, because a lot of people, particularly when it comes to villains and stuff like that, they're like, that person isn't me. They don't want to think about any part of a villain having any connection with them. But actually, I think it's important to give your villain a connection to you, not only so that you can write them well, but also so that you are creating a villain who feels like a real person, even if they are a terrible human being. They should be human, unless, of course, you're writing a villain who isn't human. But the most engaging villains are the ones who have different levels. Even, as I said, if they are horrifying people. I'm going to give you an example. De Giles.
Do you know, the minute you said villain, I was like, De Giles. It was my short code for villain. It's like, De Giles.
I think he's one of the only villains I've ever written who is one of the few villains I've ever written who is just a true psychopath. And he is a true psychopath. He is also human. And I can understand exactly what drives him. And I know exactly what he wants, what he's getting out of it, why he does everything that he does. And it's not just because he can. There is real desires there. He is a human being. And I don't want to think there's any part of me in De Giles, but there is in so much that I can understand elements of, you know, wanting certain things, etc. Not that I'm in any way like De Giles. I really need to hasten to point that out. So anyone's just there like, is she burying people in airtight boxes? I am not. But yeah, you do actually really need to think about it. And certainly I think if all villains are just De Giles, it becomes very boring. It's okay to have one, but actually De Giles isn't really the main villain of the Hamartia cycle. He's one of the key players, but he's not actually the big villain. He's not the big threat. And I do think that, yeah, the best thing you can do for a villain is to humanise them. That doesn't mean make them a good person, but humanise them. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's something I found when I haven't really done a lot in the way of sort of formal classes, but when I was learning how to properly edit a book, which was a skill I did need to acquire, so I did do a class, one of the instructors was saying, was sort of looking at the character of Hayes from I Belong to the Earth and saying, yeah, actually it's the little pinches of humanity. You want to be careful not to edit those out because those are the things that actually make us believe in him as a character. So perhaps play up those things. Most people are not willing to let the world hang just because they want to have one person back for 10 seconds. They're not willing to murder hundreds and hundreds of girls in order to do that.
Yeah.
But those tiny little pinches where it's a case of, no, he genuinely believes only he and this other person was real, and therefore losing her was losing the entire world.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly selfish motive, but that loss, that humanity, that little pinch of something that's still human, was what allowed people to say, okay, yeah, cool motive, still murder, kind of thing.
Yeah, cool motive, still murder, that's the important one.
So not a likeable character, and not supposed to be.
No, not in the least. But someone you can kind of understand why they're doing what they do.
Absolutely.
And that's very important.
Okay, so looking at our list. Okay, let's start with identity. I've sort of got little subheadings here, and I've probably got them in a different order to Madeline. So.
You do, thank you.
I'm sorry. In fact, yeah, let's start with identity and then we'll go back up. The thing is, I always scribble my notes out and then I give you the good copy. So you get the nice, neat, logical copy and I'm going off my scribbles.
you could use the nice copy too. There's nothing stopping you.
I know. There you go. There's a limit to my organisation skills, okay? I have limits too. Yeah, identity. This is a really important thing. This isn't a case of you must know every single thing about yourself. You must have the same self-knowledge at 20 as you would have, say, at 40 or at 60 or whatever. But yeah. You do need to be relatively emotionally honest with both yourself and your writing. So you do kind of need to know a fair bit about who you are in order to create a character. Because if you don't know who you are, then how can you create someone who isn't you, but out of bits of you? If that makes sense.
Yeah. Obviously, yeah, as Jules has said, we develop as people. So, you know, you don't need to completely know yourself. I think it's impossible to completely know yourself because we change as time goes on. But yeah, I think it's much easier to approach the idea of creating a nuanced character or someone who's separate from you by actually knowing yourself. But also, it kind of goes the other way around, in that you can really look at a lot of your writing and figure out a fair bit about yourself at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's something that we've brought up in other episodes, is that in order to make a reader believe what you're writing, the emotional honesty is key. But it's also the same as Madeline says for yourself. If you write with emotional honesty, then it does help you unravel certain mysteries about yourself as well.
Yeah, definitely. Ones that you might not actually expect. It's the moment where you look at your writing and go, oh, that's a trend. Is this an issue I need to deal with?
See, that Tumblr meme I saw once, it was fan fiction. Once is an accident, twice is a coincidence, three times it's the writer's kink. If you keep going, okay, they were talking about very specific fan fiction there, but I kind of think that holds true. If you find you're engaging with a theme in different projects and you get to sort of the phase where you're engaging with it a third time, it's like, that's one of your key themes. That's something you need to come back and revisit, and there's nothing wrong with that because that's telling you something about yourself.
Yeah, there's clearly something there that you need to to explore, and that's not a problem.
Right.
And I think it's also actually really good to be able to identify that, because if you can turn around and say, actually, that is something that I need to kind of explore, once you get it out of your system, you kind of have a little bit more freedom of movement to say, actually, I think I've done that a lot now. I want to explore something else.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Definitely. And, you know, I'm fine, this is a bit of a sidebar, but I'm fine with people using writing as therapy. It's not necessarily a case of writing as therapy is for everybody to read, however. There are some books that I genuinely think probably shouldn't necessarily have gone into sort of mainstream publication, just because they were clearly someone working something out rather than written for the reader. And I do feel that most books should be written for the reader as well as the writer if they're going to be published and you're going to charge people money for them.
Yeah, I think the other big danger of doing something like that is that you actually risk, if you're opening your heart out in a book, particularly a book where you need to explore certain issues from your life, you're in a dangerous position if you put that out there and then receive negative criticism for it.
Yeah, you do definitely need to develop a broad pair of shoulders before you get to that stage, I think.
Producing something which is just entirely your heart and which you haven't also considered the reader as well, that's when you've got to be a little bit careful, because you know, I wouldn't publish my diary. Not that I write a diary, but if I had a diary, I wouldn't publish it. Yeah, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Okay, right. Well, I've actually got the decent set of notes up in front of myself, and I see the bit that I've actually skipped over is the bit about lying. So let's go back to that, and then we can go back in order. We'll be singing from the same hymn sheet.
Thank you, because I was confused and I was desperately looking through the notes for where we were for quite a while.
Okay, so I mean, what I've put down is actors are the greatest liars, but writers come a close second. With the use of the word liar, I don't mean someone who is doing it for malicious or malevolent reasons. This is not someone who is getting off on lying. This is a case of if you think about it, if you like, lying is an extension of very, very strong, all immersive make-believe. So, I mean, everyone must have played make-believe as a child at some point or other. And it's an extension of that. And it's very much the same with writers. Actors are essentially learning to lie with their entire being, their entire body, by making themselves somebody else. Particularly your presentational actor, who thinks themselves into the character part and then, you know, essentially becomes that character if they do it well. Writers do something very similar. If you don't fall a bit in love with your love interest, if you don't root for your protagonist, if you don't want to lock horns with your villain, then you're probably not writing something that's very compelling.
Yeah. I think the other side of it is that it's ultimately about, as you say, it's lying, but it's ultimately about creating an illusion.
Yeah, absolutely.
And an illusion which is all-encompassing. And when you're an actor, you know, that involves thinking about the physicality of what you're putting forward, the small nuances of facial expression and stuff like that. And you don't have exactly the same problems when you are just writing an illusion instead. But what you have instead is basically actually having to create an illusion, be responsible for an illusion the whole way around, the entire experience. So it's less focus on what their facial expression is, but there's just as much focus on what exactly they're saying, what exactly they're feeling at any given time, how the world around them is reacting, because you're doing more than lying for one character. You're lying an entire world into existence.
Yeah, exactly. And hopefully, if you're good enough, someone will give you some money for that as well, you know?
So, I believe in your world.
Shut up and take my money kind of thing. I want to live in your world for a bit. That is the idea. As Madeline says, if you're a writer, then you are lying an entire world into existence. And ideally, it's somewhere that you want people to want to visit and pay the price of admission, ideally. Filthy lucre. But, you know, we can't live without it, so... We ought to try making it in a way that is producing something creative, a thing of loveliness, or
yes,
at least lovely horror, you know, one or the other.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, so in order to lie effectively, then we're back to sort of learning these techniques and things. So we've talked about identity, and next on the list, we've got substitution, which is quite a chunk of a topic, actually, but... We'll look at it because it's a really interesting one.
Yeah.
So, substitution. Let's take... My God, I hate this play so much. But let's take A Streetcar Named Desire by Tennessee Williams, which I did genuinely throw that book at the wall when I had to study it for A-level. But I have since seen productions of it which were done quite well. And where the character of Blanche DuBois, who is basically your sort of fading, aging Southern Belle type, who's grown up in a big antebellum style mansion or whatever. Now, clearly the actress in that case had not actually had that kind of upbringing. She hadn't come from old money, an old family that had started to lose its money. She wasn't trying to occupy the new world while still being her old self, etc., etc. But the... Yeah. actor who was playing her had actually managed to make the substitution in her head.
Yes.
So she'd found something that worked for her to give her the same emotional resonance as if she genuinely had those experiences. And as a writer, if you have a character who is doing something that you know, as a writer, that your character might be doing something that you're never going to get to do because, I don't know, perhaps you're not telekinetic, for example.
Yeah.
But you need to find a substitution. You need to find something that will give you the same feeling because then your character will feel it as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I've mentioned this before probably on the podcast, and also I always talk about it with my students, is that one of the main things is how many of them, I'll use Harry Potter as an example, I say, well, how many of them were raised in a cupboard under the stairs? How many of them, you know, have parents were killed by an evil wizard? how many of them, and you know, we continue on like that, how many of them have gone through this experience? And very few of them had owls or flew on brooms. It was very surprising, and I was like, well, I don't understand. If none of you have had this experience, why are you all, you know, how can you all really enjoy Harry Potter? And I said, it's very simple, particularly with the first ones. Harry Potter is set in this completely magical, fantastical world, and yet it is substituted with all of these very, very normal things that we all understand in life. For example, having a sort of a bully, a kind of a rival bully character, having a teacher who isn't very nice to you, or who always seems to be on your back. You know, making best friends, being nervous about going to school, enjoying sports, the pleasure of food, all of these kinds of things, and their sense of mystery. And the other great thing that basically allowed Harry Potter to be so easy to kind of jump into was obviously the fact that Harry is experiencing all of this for the first time. Which means that we can experience it through him, with him, at the same time. And that does make a significant difference. And so that's where the substitution came in a lot of ways. We can understand his experience because we've had similar experiences, even if we're not, you know, part of that particular extreme kind of experience.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and some experiences are absolutely universal. There will have been a time, assuming your memory is good enough, where you have felt that things were horribly unfair as a child. Now, whether they were genuinely horribly unfair, or whether it was a case of your perspective was they were horribly unfair, but as an adult you can look back and see that perhaps they weren't, it was just the way things were. That you can tap into that feeling, because that feeling was real at the time.
Yes.
No one can take that away from you. And you can take it and you can extend it and you can exaggerate it, and then you can build circumstances around it. So the whole idea of being the unwanted boy in the house and having to live in a cupboard under the stairs, you know, it's kind of, it's so extreme, it's possible. And it's also possible because it's built around this sense of childhood unfairness, where adults are kind of illogical creatures that don't make sense to a child in a lot of ways. They have the power and they can be unfair if they choose to be.
And I think it's also why you have so many of these YA books where the dystopian, the people who are saving the world, are these young adults rather than the adults, because I think we've all been in that position where we look at the state of the world and we go, why aren't our politicians doing anything? Why aren't these adults doing anything? It would be so easy to do it. And obviously that's sometimes an oversimplification and sometimes it's not. But I think particularly as young people, there's that sense of powerlessness, but also coupled with a real kind of drive for change and, you know, the sudden consciousness of the world around you, which I think we can all kind of understand. And that's where it comes from, even though very few of us, you know, have had to fight in massive, you know, mediated games with crossbows and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so feeding into substitution, observation. Observation is kind of key to all these other little bits and pieces that we're talking about. It might be something that you do perfectly naturally anyway, because you just notice things. If you're not a natural observer, then it's something you can train yourself to be. So all these things we're talking about, none of them are out of anybody's reach. I think sometimes far too much emphasis is put on talent versus someone putting the work in. I've heard too many times that, you know, that you can either act or you can't, or you can write or you can't, and those things are just not true. You can learn to be a good writer, you can learn to be a good actor, and someone with natural talent might well start the race at an advantage. They'll start, I don't know, half a mile ahead of you. And, you know, that sucks, but that's a bit like sort of like some people are born with better genetics for being a dancer. Or a runner, and that's just the way the dice falls. That doesn't mean you can't enter the games at all. So you can absolutely learn writing technique. You can learn these deep characterization techniques. If you want, you can learn to be an actor properly.
Mm.
And maybe you won't make it to Hollywood because, you know, there are a lot of luck is involved in that. And maybe you won't be a multi-million best-selling author because, again, luck is involved in that. But you might be a damn good mid-lister with your own audience that loves you and supports you and actually, you know, keeps you in stockings and fans, as I've said before. That's perfectly possible. That doesn't mean you shouldn't reach for the stars, but, you know, don't be heartbroken if you end up just on the moon instead, kind of thing.
Yeah, the moon's a pretty good place to be. Well, I mean, well, if you have the right equipment otherwise.
Assuming you've got oxygen. Yeah. Okay, that metaphor did not go as well as I should, as I hoped. Nevertheless, reach for the heavens. Okay, so back to observation. Observation can come in at any point. You can be paying attention to how people react on social media.
Yeah.
Don't let this be an excuse for you getting drawn into a fight. Just observe. Think about the way people talk to each other. Think about the things that set people off.
Yeah.
Watch people on the news, on sort of reality type programs, if you can possibly stomach them. Watch them in real life. If you happen to take a bus journey, observe what other people are doing. When you're out for a walk, look at how people stand and talk to each other, or if you're in a public place. I mean, I don't stand there and be an absolute creeper and stare at people and take pictures or anything.
Yeah.
You're going to get in trouble. But, you know, pay attention. Yeah. Obviously, pay attention within your own families and things as well.
Yeah. It's quite... when we were little, we had to travel a lot. And so... as young kids, we spent a lot of time at train stations and airports and bus stations and all of that jazz. And one of the ways that my mother could occupy two young kids was to people watch. And the thing was to basically look at these people going past and say, what's their story? What are they doing? Where are they going? There are a surprising amount of murderers. Surprising amount of murderers just wandering around with bodies in their suitcases, but hey ho. And
you were a morbid child, Madeline.
Hey, it wasn't just me.
Yes, but I don't know your brother as well.
But yeah, and actually it's quite fun, and you can do it in two ways. You can sort of project onto people in some way, project a story, look at them and say, what is their story? But then also try to, rather than project, take a step back, look at them and kind of play detective a tiny bit, you know, take note of what they're wearing and think, what can that mean? You know, take note of how big their suitcase is and wonder, okay, what does that mean for what, where they might be going or how long they're going or things like that. You can actually play detective with it, and it's actually quite fun if you do.
Yeah, and that's an excellent and fun way of teaching yourself to be an observer. Yeah. Presumably, people who go into sort of being private investigators do similar things.
Yes.
But yeah, look at people's speech patterns, look at how they gesticulate when they talk, look at their body language. I promise you, even if you never use these skills in writing, they'll be very useful at some point in your life.
Yeah, definitely. The other thing to look at is something that we don't tend to think about is the tell. A person's tell. Yeah. If you play poker or any kind of card game, knowing a tell is actually quite a useful thing.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Let me just check. I'm definitely still... Yeah. Okay, so flaws.
Yes.
So obviously flaws as in a character defect, not flaws as in the floor, as opposed to the ceiling. I just suddenly realised that I might need to distinguish. I maintain that you can build an entire character if you just start with a really good flaw, because it's a bit like an oyster building a pearl around a speck of grit.
Yeah.
In the sense of how somebody reacts to pretty much everything in their life, how they act proactively, can be determined by their big character flaw. So if you're... Okay, I'll take M as an example.
Yes.
Her big character flaw is she detests asking for help.
Yes.
Her big character journey is she has to learn to be okay with A, accepting help, B, believing she deserves it, and C, actually actively asking for it. And... it gets her into all sorts of predicaments that she could have got out of a lot more easily and with a lot less pain if she just asked for help. So that, I mean, that's quite a big one, because there's a certain amount of arrogance inherent in not wanting to ask for help, but there's also, you know, an unfortunate sort of I can manage this by myself pride. But there's also good stuff. There's self-sufficiency. There's a sense of responsibility. So, you know, there's good and bad things bizarrely built up around this flaw. It's just, at what point do you allow the flaw to take over?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other really key thing is that the flaw is almost always connected with the positives, the virtues. We tend to think of them as being separate. We tend to think of all of these things as being separate, but they're not. They're all part of one basic thing, really.
Yeah, basically, somebody's greatest strength and their greatest weakness will have their roots in the same thing.
Yeah. So it's actually really quite crucial to consider the flaw, because it will actually show you another side to them. Why does someone act in this way? Well, simply put, because actually it also shows that M is someone who is very conscientious. She doesn't want to bother other people. She's very self-sufficient. She's got a lot of strength. You know, there are all of these things which are all tied in. And I think the problem with thinking of a flaw is, again, thinking of it as something separate, when really it's the branch of a tree. And everything is connected. And it's why it's really, really important to therefore think about these things very carefully.
Yeah, definitely.
So yeah, a good flaw, I agree with you. You can start with a very good flaw, and that will make a good house. I'm sorry.
That was an odd mental image, but I do agree with you. And yeah, I mean, if you're not sure about this, then go back to some books that you like. Take your favourite characters, try and identify their main flaw. There is this idea within sort of classic Greek literature that there is a hamartia, there is hubris, there is the one fatal flaw within a character that will cause their downfall. But this same fatal flaw quite often sets them on the path of adventure and could quite as easily have been turned to good account as bad account. So no, you don't have to go back and read Greek plays if you don't want to, that's fine. But look at some of your favourite books with this sort of idea in mind, and you'll start to suddenly identify it in your own character once you've done a few.
Yeah. And it's also, identifying the fatal flaws can also really help with identifying actually what your character's journey needs to be. You know, and that's, you know, Jules mentioned that earlier on in terms of M and what her character journey was, and ultimately what was stopping her from achieving her goal, particularly in the first book, and it's something that she continues to work on for a very long time. Sorry, that sounds like that's like saying, "Oh, she should have." No, I don't mean like that. I mean, it's something that continues to develop, which is excellent. But it allows you to basically say, right, what is the fundamental change that my character needs to have in order to complete their journey? And here we're tapping into, you know, the monomyth, we're tapping into the hero's journey, where ultimately some kind of revelation needs to take place. And it's about emerging from the end of the story as a slightly better person. And that doesn't necessarily mean a better person as in, you know, a Scrooge character who goes around throwing, you know, chocolates and stuff like that. But more in terms of a character who is self-aware. And I think that, you know, we talked about knowing yourself, and you kind of need to then take it to the next step, and your character needs to know themselves by the end of the story. If you're going for that kind of buildings romance, a book where there has been a change achieved at the end.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, this one's kind of got two parts, and that's origins. So you need to know where your character has come from, in the sense of you need to know what their... You kind of need to know what their origin story is, even if their origin story is well, I grew up in a small council house with mum and dad. We didn't have a lot of money. There were three brothers. You know, even if their origin story was really humble, you'd need to know where they've come from, because that origin story will have affected their outlook on life.
Yeah.
Obviously, the other part of this is when you're entering a scene with a character, you need to know where that character has literally just come from. They didn't just spring up on the page or in the scene from nowhere. I mean, they might have physically for you, the actor or you, the writer, but everybody watching or reading cannot believe that. They need to think you've come from somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. In something which was actually taught to me by Imogen Cooper, is the idea of the strength of actually building a family tree for your character, even including characters who are not there. So, you know, even if your character is an orphan, build the family tree anyway. Even if your book never even mentions the grandparents and stuff like that, include them. Why? Because we are a product of our upbringing. And if, you know, if your character does have parents who are present in some way or another, they are a product of their upbringing. And so there are going to be trends and things and behaviours which are going to be cast down. These are things which may never even end up in the book. You might never even detail the relationship between mother and grandmother. It doesn't matter. The important thing is that you basically go into it with a strong understanding of why your character is the way that they are. Why is their relationship with their father like that? Well, because the father came from a very religious upbringing and was either, you know, continuing on with it or was pushing away from it, or that there was abuse, not from the parents, but from the parents' parents. And so that affected certain behaviours, etc. It's a really, really good idea to have a strong foundation of all of the elements which have come together, both genetic and you know, situational, which have come together to produce this particular character.
Yeah, definitely. And that is something that's really important. And that is something that I know that a lot of actors do. Obviously, they generally get what's written on the page, but they need to have a rough idea where that person's from. Yeah. And, you know, build on it from there and make it personal to them. So you, the writer, needs to do the same thing with your characters. And I know this sounds like a lot of work, but this doesn't necessarily mean you have to write reams and reams of notes. It just means that when you're, I don't know, let's take, I don't know, I'll take Craig from the Unveiled series.
Mm-hmm.
Craig's actually come from a much more underprivileged background than the rest of the characters.
Yeah.
He's come from Peckham, and he's from an ethnic minority. He's obviously very intelligent. He's managed to get himself into a top university. And there are times when, particularly since he speaks with a slight East End accent as well, where mm-hmm. it's not that he feels very slightly out of place amongst all these other people, even though they're absolutely accepting of him.
Yeah.
There are times when it's a case of, it's a culture shock. Because he's come from one place where one set of rules applied and a new set of rules in a different place, in a much more, I suppose, privileged surrounding, if you like.
Yeah.
So going from Peckham to Edinburgh University was, you know, kind of a big thing. So on the one hand, you've got the triumph of moving up like that. And on the other hand, you've got the, do I ever really fit in? Which means he comes across as quite brusque and surly. Yeah. There are other reasons for that as well, but...
Yes.
quite good ones as well.
Yeah, some fairly good. Trauma will do that to you.
Yes. So it's that idea as well. Sort of, I don't necessarily give you a massive lump of backstory about him. In fact, I don't think I really give you a lump of backstory about him unless you choose to read his little novella. And even then, it's not a huge amount of stuff. But no. You kind of get the impression of who he is and where he's from.
Yeah. To be honest, the thing that I really liked about that was just also that there was a very slight thing where he, you know, why is he such a nut when it comes to kind of gym and stuff like that?
Yeah.
And that's just very much to do with he's a slightly small guy. And at first, you know, we did that, you know, just for fun. And then obviously it's a response to kind of trauma.
Yeah.
But there are all of these, you know, elements that are coming into play, in that it's not just I feel small, therefore I want to kind of look bigger. You know, there was one tiny strand of that when he was a teenager.
Yeah.
And then it was actually, this is something that makes me feel good. And then it was, I need these endorphins to kind of, there were so many links that kind of play into it. And for me, it just made him such a realistic character. That's why I love that lot as well, because also the other thing that I liked was that they're all on different levels, which means that different things will annoy them, and they will get annoyed, and they will bark, and they will argue, and they will make mistakes. It's not just, we are a unit, therefore at all times we agree with one another. They all do have off days.
Yeah, it is something I'm finding with Steve at the moment, because Steve has come from a very well-off family. He's from very old money, as in sort of practically grew up in a mansion, and is very embarrassed about it.
Yeah.
And spends a lot of time trying to make his quite plummy accent sound a little bit less obvious, with limited success. And so, you know, the way people act, he sometimes finds people rude or too casual or that, because everything he's been taught is different, even though he's been an outsider in his own family. So, yeah, I know I'm drawing a lot of my own work here, but
nothing wrong
origins
with that.
Origins are definitely an important factor, even if you don't ever really explain what those character origins are.
Yeah, definitely. It makes a significant difference.
Okay, next one is potentially a painful one, actually, because this is one where you have to dig quite deep, and that's emotional memory. We talked about substitution. This is kind of like substitution plus. This is a case of you need your character to feel a burst of big emotion. So grief or loneliness or jealousy or even some of the more positive emotions. You know, we could do the positive ones too. Consuming rage, that sort of thing. And you've kind of got to be able to switch on yourself. So very much like we've talked about in books when we've talked about world building, where we've said you don't actually need to write down every single description of every leaf. You just need to know it's there and it comes out in your writing. Yeah. If you can make yourself feel, however briefly, what the character is feeling when you're writing that particular scene, it will come out in your writing. And you don't need to say, he was angry, he was doing this, etc. There's an awful lot of tell in many books about how people are feeling instead of showing it.
Yeah.
And I think when you are doing deep characterization, you display it better by feeling it yourself and then just letting your characters naturally take the path they want to. And if you've done all this other stuff, if you've worked on identity and substitution and observation, and you know what the character flaw is and what their journey is, and you know where they've come from, you'll find that doing the emotional memory bit will fit really easily. But it's kind of having the guts to go there.
Yeah. And I think that there's a tough side of this as well, because it's very easy to actually just start to project a little bit too much.
Yeah.
In some cases, when you hit, let's say you're digging into the well of your emotional memory and you hit something, and suddenly what your character is experiencing and how they're, you know, showing that is actually it's just you. It's not actually them anymore, which can make it quite difficult to find the balance between making what they feel and how it's expressed believable, and actually then also keeping them in character. One of the things that I find that tends to work quite well is to actually cultivate a number of different songs. I usually use soundtracks, but you could use something else, which really are tied only with a particular character. So kind of create a sound, you know, a soundtrack for them, a soundtrack for their life. And listen to that song when you are kind of getting behind that character. For example, you might have, there are lots of different ways of feeling sadness and grief. So a song that you might want to have, you could have a song which is all sweeping strings and all sort of like big and epic and huge emotions. You could have one which is just a very quiet piano and it's very reserved. You could have one which is actually quite angry as well, you know, has got guitars and people screaming and stuff like that. And actually kind of having that a little bit, because obviously music can really help develop, bring out our emotions, is actually a really nice way of sometimes if you're struggling to differentiate these emotions between different characters, it's quite a nice way of kind of refining it a little bit. So that's just a little, that's a little trick that you can use if you're struggling with this.
Yeah, definitely. Managed not to laugh there as I as I thought about book four and the fact that I think I messaged you to say, I've just created Kieran's moping playlist.
Yes.
I have to admit, emotional memory-wise, I found writing some of Kieran's stuff quite difficult because I've never really experienced that kind of jealousy. So, as Madeline said, creating a playlist and then trying to find something to substitute it worked quite well for me, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Moving on from emotional memory, sense memory. This is an interesting one. This is more kind of a stimuli for your character. So,
yeah.
Obviously, you've got your five main senses. We won't talk about a sixth one right now. But everyone reacts to sense stimuli in a different way. So for one person, the smell of cut grass could mean that summer's coming. For someone else, it could mean, oh God, that was the smell that was permeating the day we buried Great Aunt Bessie or what have you, because they just cut the graves. I don't know. That's what I mean. For one person, the sound of rain could be really soothing. For someone else, it can mean, oh God, I'm trapped indoors.
Yeah. This is so... sorry, I didn't mean to laugh.
You're quite right.
So this is what I was talking about earlier on, is about method writing, which ties in with the power of the senses. And as Jules says... each of the senses, you know, there are going to be different things which are going to provoke different reactions. You know, for some people, they'll hear a classical piano and suddenly it'll take them right back to when they were little and their mother was playing the piano. And it's this sense of great relief. For instance, I hear opera and I get the sense of great sleepiness because every Sunday when I was a kid, Dad would put on classic FM on Sunday morning when he got up to do stuff. And that's what I would wake up to. I'd wake up to sort of these faraway sounds of classical music. And it was this sense of great relaxation and being home and comfort and Sunday. And yeah, so it has great, great connotations for me. Whereas for other people, it's this, you know, it's like nails on a chalkboard, you know.
Yeah.
It's boring. It's kind of stiff. So there are really going to be a lot of ways that we're going to sort of experience different stimuli. Method writing is actually also about going out there and trying to feel and see and listen and experience the things that your characters did. It's particularly useful if you have been, if you're writing historical stuff or things like that. For example, one of the, for me, quite fun ways that you could do method writing is to actually put on a costume, pick up a sword, you know, try and write with a quill, handle old coins. I think, you know, lots of people have had that experience where you're going to hang out the laundry, you put the basket on your hip and suddenly you're a peasant woman. You know what I mean? Or you're kneading bread and suddenly you're a busy servant in a household and the master will be in any minute and, you know.
Or the one
I'm
where...
not the only one who's had these experiences, right?
Or the one where you're plunging a hot pan into the dishwater and you're kind of like, ah, oh, I'm forging something.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. And it's that's what it is. That's a sort of method writing or method acting, where basically you are physically trying to experience it, and by experiencing it, putting yourself in the mindset of the character. So you can use soundscapes as well. Soundscapes are a great way of doing it. Ambient mixes and stuff like that, where suddenly you can sit and go, ah, no, this feels relaxing because to my character it would feel relaxing, or the smell, that particular smell for me turns my stomach, but this is what they've been smelling every day of their life. They're used to this. You know what I mean? It can really, really make a difference. And it's actually quite a fun way of doing it. And particularly at the moment, while we're in isolation, you might as well.
Yeah,
absolutely. Now is the time to put on silly costumes and prance around with swords in the garden, if you have a sword.
Yeah, carefully with swords as well, unless yes. You know how to use them. Right, physicality. I know a lot of people would be like, well, if you're talking about acting, then surely you should be talking about the physicality at the beginning. Mm. And perhaps you're right, but certainly as a writer, I think you kind of need to build these other layers up first, and then think about how their physicality would be affected by things. So we've talked about origins, so that's things like how they speak, the syntax, the patterns of and rhythm of their speech. Everyone's got a different pattern and rhythm of speech, for example. Accents, which, you know, I'm now sort of bitterly regretting. No, not really. Just need to practice. But you might also think about things like their habits. You might think about how they stand and hold themselves. If they're an insecure person, does their body language communicate that, or do they try and hide it? And these things are important.
Yeah. Definitely. It's also things like, what about slouching and stuff? That seems like such a very, very small thing, but there's lots to consider. What do they do with their time? Are they behind a desk a lot of the time? Or actually, are they a dancer or something like that? Therefore, they keep their, you know, they actually stand up very upright, or a musician of some kind. You know, if you're someone who plays, a particular instrument or a singer, you might also have a larger lung capacity and things like that, which makes a difference. So there are lots of things to consider. In terms of the physicality as well of what the person looks like, that is something that you might also want to consider. You'll want to consider what does their hair, their skin type, what does that say about, first of all, the kind of person they are, if it's hair, because you can change hair. What kind of haircut do they have? Because that will tell you a little bit about them, how they want to be seen, how they want to be presented. What skin colour do they have? Does that cause them issues where they are? Does that make them also, you know, is that tied to identity or things like that? And that's not just in terms of racism, but things like as well, what if, you know, they have acne, you know, or lots of freckles or things like that. How does that play in? Because again, the way that we are presented changes the way that other people react to us. And that's the way that we choose to be presented and the way that we're naturally presented as well. What are the things that your character is embarrassed about? And this is particularly also important if you're writing characters who are supernatural in some way. It's very easy to say they're like that because of magic. But you might also want to consider, okay, let's say you have a group of people who actually, spend most of their time underground. They've spent millions of years underground. What are they going to look like? Well, for a start, H.G. Wells is where the subterranean people all had dark skin. Yeah. Doesn't make any sense, because you'd have very pale skin so that you could get that vitamin D whenever you did emerge. You might have very dark eyes, though. you know, huge, huge blown pupils and things like that. But, you know, there'd be other things to think about. If they're in certain environments, how will they have adapted? What kind of hair will they have? What kind of skin will they have? Will they have adapted to have larger lungs, shorter legs, longer arms? You know, all of these kinds of things that come into play the moment you have a new sort of species. And it is really worth thinking about and considering.
Definitely. I agree with everything Madeline's just said. I will add the caveat of... do not make the mistake of having physical appearance as a substitute for characterization. In the same way, you'll notice that Madeline and I have not specifically talked about a character's sexuality or gender or anything like that, because those things are a facet, but they're not actually characterization in their own right. And there is obviously far too much of this is the beautiful one and this is the gay one, you know, the kind of token characters that sort of orbit around the main character who might have a bit more characterization. And honestly, I think everybody who comes onto your stage or your page should have some characterization, even if they then don't come back again.
Yeah, it's a little bit thinking about it like that, you know. It's like saying being gay, being, you know, part of a minority, being all of these kinds of things, that is an ingredient in a pot. It is not the meal itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it will certainly add things. You know, for example, if they are a gay person and they're in a very oppressive society, that is going to actually play a lot into their story, because that's going to be something which is probably causing them a high amount of stress, which will cause other things to come forward. Okay, so that's absolutely fine. But just saying, yeah, they're gay, therefore that is that. That's just who they are. They are the gay one.
That is the sum total of their character. It's like, yeah, try not to make it a tick box exercise. And it's the same. It's the same with physical appearance as well. And to be honest, you can think about physical appearance and never really describe what a character looks like. It all depends on the genre that you're writing in. I like a little bit of physical description, both in reading and writing. But it's, you know, as long as the character's done well, I don't absolutely need it.
Yeah.
I like to add a bit of physical description because generally the genres I write in, people like to know what a character looks like.
Yeah, definitely.
But I don't go on for 5 or 6 pages, like, with it describing the exact shape of someone's eyebrows and the shade of their hair, etc., etc. It's something, again, that you build up, and you build up as you go through.
Yeah.
I also don't really like the thing where in the first chapter you get the character sort of describing what they look like, as in, it's a bit info dumpy, isn't it? And also, one of the cheapest tricks is when you have a character who looks in the mirror at themselves and then describes themselves to you. And it's like, how many of us do that on a daily basis?
Sorry, it's the typical when a male author writes about female a woman who stops, steps out of the shower, looks at herself in the mirror, and just goes, "Let's examine my breasts."
It is, and generally, she is just a pair of breasts. Probably with blonde hair.
Yeah.
But, you know...
But maybe one of her lips is slightly uneven.
Oh, yes, because that's the character flaw.
Yeah.
I think Tolstoy was the first one who did that. Although he did actually give her a character as well, in fairness. But, God. Yeah, so it's not acceptable, and obviously breasts aren't, again, a substitute for characterization as well.
No.
I mean, we all like a pair of breasts, but, you know, just there's got to be something attached there.
Anyway, right. And on that revelation,
she must be more than a pair of breasts and a tight pair of pants. That's the other one I've seen. I say pants, but I really mean trousers, because we're in the UK.
Yes. And seriously. Anyway.
Right, let's look at some, we'll just describe a few exercises that you can try out by yourself or with a friend.
Mm-hmm.
That sounded really dicey for characterization. Things you can do, because we just talked about boobs, I'm sorry. This does not involve
you can do this that. Alone or with a friend.
Improvisation, which is obviously a great one for actors, but it's also a great one for writers, and you can do it by yourself. I know an awful lot of writers are not okay with the sound of their own voice. I promise you that you get over that shyness and it stops being an issue. If you have an inbuilt microphone, you can just get a program like Audacity and you can record yourself. And I know this sounds nuts, but you can record yourself monologuing as that character and listen back to it. And if you can get yourself over the, oh God, that's what I really sound like phase.
Yeah.
It can be a lot of fun.
Yeah,
it really
definitely.
Can. If you don't like that, you can do it on paper. You can literally just write out something. Just think yourself into that character headspace and then think, I'm going to free write for 5 minutes. What's this character thinking?
Yes. Yeah. That can be very helpful when you do something like that. You can also, if you're feeling like, actually, I feel a bit stupid doing this and you're really struggling to kind of get into the mode of doing it, try walking around while you're doing it. There's something to be said about physical movement, which actually can really help with the process.
Yeah, definitely. Another thing you can try, lighting fires or displacing your character in time and place. This is something that I did with one of my writing buddies way, way back before I'd written my first book. And it's a good one also for getting you unstuck. Basically, take your main character and put them in a situation that they would never normally be in. So I think in one instance, I had M trying to defuse a nuclear bomb. In another one, she was helping someone else try to steal a car.
Yes.
And because you've dislocated your character from their time and place and the things they would actually be doing, it's incredibly freeing. You find your character starting to take over more and more.
Yeah.
And you'll learn a lot more about your character than you actually knew as well.
Yeah, it's actually a lot of fun.
It's got like the coffee shop I use for fan fiction, isn't it?
It really is, and that's exactly what I was thinking of, is that actually it's something that I've done quite a lot because I actually really do enjoy doing it, which is the displacement where you take your characters and just put them somewhere entirely new. Like, one thing I like to ask myself is, you know, you can be quite cheeky about it in some ways. You could say, like, okay, if they were sent to Hogwarts, which Hogwarts house would they be in? What kind of classes would they be good at? But you can also do it like, I think it was Amelia, if Amelia is listening, who wrote a Hamartia Cycle university AU where they're all just at university together in a at a flat share, just Rufus and Luca and Faye, Emmerich, and Marcel and Zachary. And it was the question of, okay, so what would they be studying if they were all together? What's their subject? What are their lives like? What are the things which are consistent about them? And what are the things which are situational? And it is really good fun. And it's a really nice way of exploring character because you get to understand the things which are at the core of their, you know, their core aspects and the things which have developed simply because of the plot or the situation that they're in.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And again, with the it getting you unstuck thing, because you can focus too much on what should be happening rather than letting things happen naturally.
Yeah.
So going somewhere else and having them help to cover up a murder or something can be quite liberating.
Yeah. And throwing them into a different setting is just my favourite thing, particularly if you've watched a movie of something. I think another one I did was a noir, was a noir detective story, and that was hilariously fun. Yeah. So yeah, highly recommended. It's actually also a really nice way if you're just stuck in a rut in general with kind of what to do, because at the end of the day, you're also practicing your craft. You're not wasting time by writing at any point. So highly recommended. Yes. And good fun.
and this is one that Matt and I used quite a lot when we were doing the Battle of Hastings duology. And
just doing the Battle of Hastings.
We were doing
the
Battle of Hastings. We were basically, obviously, Matt wrote one perspective and I wrote the other. And then we were getting to the point where the two characters had to meet up.
Mm.
And we were going to have to start writing each other's characters, but from the other character's perspective as well.
Yeah.
So I said, well, what we'll do is we'll get a chat stream going and you'll role play one and I will role play the other.
Yes.
And we'll just freestyle the conversation. And we did. And it was amazing. And it was a case of it was because we'd really sort of nailed down the characterization so far, we were just bouncing off each other really well. And a lot of those conversations that we had actually made it into the books almost verbatim. So with a bit of tidying up.
That's brilliant.
And things. So that was really good. But you can do this by yourself. You can freestyle it. So literally what you do is you don't write out descriptive passages. You just take a couple of your characters and you freestyle dialogue.
Yeah.
Or maybe you want to freestyle it with a friend. So I don't know. I suppose this is kind of what Madeline and I have done with Em and Kestrel. In fact, we've actually done it in chat streams in Facebook where we've said, oh, yes. what if this happened? And you'd be like, oh, Kestra would be like this. And then you started writing dialogue. So I started writing Emma's dialogue.
Yeah. And
we've just pissed about. It was just a bit of fun. But even that mucking around gave us more insight into the characters.
I actually had a strange situation where a little while back I was doing this with another friend of mine, Rebecca. And I'd forgotten that we'd done it and I'd saved the chat. And I found the chat later on and it had her name and my name on it. And I was reading the conversation like, what the hell happened? When did this occur? Like, because it's this very intense conversation about some really intense stuff. And I was like, wait, no, these are characters. These aren't actually us. I was genuinely concerned and confused for like a full minute before I remembered.
Yeah, and it can be a really, really fun one to do, I think.
Yeah.
I think that was some of Matt and my favourite bits of Oath and Crown was the, okay, we need to work out this bit, shall we freestyle it? It just got to be one of those things that was really good fun. Final one, this is an early technique I used, and that's character interviews, and that can sound quite boring, but it's a good way, just imagine yourself as some sort of reporter or interviewer, and you sit your character down and you mentally sit them down, obviously. Hopefully you're not fully hallucinating. Although maybe you are, as long as you can come out of it again. Start off with a really inane question. I always start off with, what's your favourite colour?
Yeah.
And then you just gradually get more and more complicated. And you can ask them specific questions about the plot as it unfolds as well and why they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
And it kind of worked really well. The one I did with Kieran was absolutely heartbreaking. So I learned so much, but I was so upset afterwards. The one I did with Hayes was terrifying. As in...
Yeah, I bet.
As in, he started off being sort of like, I'm not answering this, this is stupid. And then he told me I wasn't real. And then I said, well, I can write you any way I want. And then he said, I'd like to see you try. And he got by to the end of this interview. He was really threatening me. I've still got it somewhere. But it was incredibly eye-opening as well. It was a case of this was a way of making them even more real in my own head. So that when I came to write those parts of the story, and I think I was 2/3 of the way through I Belong to the Earth when I wrote it, I think that's why the last sort of third of the book was written so quickly and needed so little adjustment, because by the time I got to that part, I'd done these character interviews and it was just sort of there and it all clicked.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's got to be said. I think I don't think I'd have the courage to interview some of my characters. I've definitely interviewed other ones. And it has been really eye-opening and a lot of fun. But yeah, I definitely would not have the
Can you imagine courage. Interviewing to Giles?
I was just thinking that. Like, I don't want to go
be
anywhere.
Worse than Hayes.
I don't want to go anywhere near that dude.
I want to talk to him. So why do you bury people alive?
Well, I know exactly why he does it. But the thing, once again, I did actually... this is a situation where I did actually write an AU where De Giles turned out to be a bit of a Hannibal Lecter-esque character who was Zachary's shrink. And that went about as well as you can imagine.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
But yeah, I think I would be a little bit too afraid to interview him. I might pluck up the courage to interview some other characters, I think. It is just a really nice and good technique. And it's also something that can be quite fun. Again, if you don't really know how to do it, you can also then mix this with a freestyle with a friend, where you actually get a friend to interview you as the character while you interview them.
Yeah.
So that can be a nice little social way of doing it. I'm making these suggestions just in terms of right now we're in isolation, and this can actually be quite a nice way of kind of getting the ball rolling. So if you want to kind of combine it with, you know, something to do with a friend, come up with interview questions for each other. It's quite fun.
Yeah, definitely. One final exercise I'd suggest, and use with caution because I've ended up with a couple of extra books because of this, but write a scene, or write a difficult scene, from the other character's perspective or another key character's perspective. Yeah, I genuinely have ended up with books because of this.
Yes,
but if you're trying to nail down what your character thinks and feels and how perhaps they appear to others and why the other characters are working that way, write it from the other character's perspective. So, I mean, I've got scenes from Grace's perspective, for I Belong to the Earth, for example.
Yeah.
Particularly where they're arguing. And it sort of, it changed how I thought about writing that part of the book. And I ended up feeding some of that in there as well. So, you know, it's never wasted. It's always really useful and definitely helps you nail character.
Yeah, it is very, very useful. And it's very useful for me because Jules does it. And then I get more content.
Yes. This is what happened with The King's Knight recently. It's like, oh, well, I'll turn this little scene into a short story for Madeline for her birthday. Sort of like, what was it? Something like 60,000 words later. I'm like, okay, so you're getting a book for your birthday, Madeline. I hope you like it.
It's great. It's wonderful. It's when you're like, oh, yes, I wrote this scene from that person's perspective. I'm like, I really want to see this scene from their perspective. And then I just hear Jules cursing and I hear her typing like, all right, I'll write the whole book.
Meanwhile, Madeline's grinning and rubbing her hands because she loves it when a plan comes together.
my little greedy, grabby raccoon hands, yes.
So just to wrap up this part of the podcast, basically, it sounds like it can, hopefully what we've said has given you ideas about things to do with your own characters and ways to reach characterization that you hadn't perhaps thought of in the way that we've discussed today.
Yeah,
it sounds really complicated. It's not. Think about it. Maybe you don't build a house at all, but if you were building a house, you wouldn't just slap it down on whatever. You'd start with foundations. So think about it as putting in good foundations and then building from there.
And remember make sure that there's a good floor.
Yes, always remember to have a good floor. Definitely
in your house.
That's a key one. Well, not in the house, but definitely in the character. Don't really want a floor in the house.
You need a floor. No, that was my pun, Jules. You need a good floor in the house and a good floor in your character.
Okay, I'm sorry. That was too there for me. Apparently too realistic. It's not as complicated as it sounds, but hopefully you're coming away from this feeling all enthusiastic and we want to try out these techniques. Obviously, get in touch. Let us know how it works out for you.
Yeah, definitely. Do also please send in any other suggestions for things that you would like to hear about. And remember, we're still open for your favourite quotes, moments or episodes. So do leave us a comment, get in touch. We're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, and you can also get in touch with us via both of our websites, which is jaiandsawyer.com and madelinevaughan.com. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, you've got one for us this week, I believe.
I have, and most unusually for me, it is a graphic novel. It's actually free to read online at the moment on Webtoons, and it's Always Human by Ari North. I've talked before about how difficult I find reading graphic novels, but this was really, really good. It's coming out in June, if you would rather have the paperback version, and I'd say it was well worth having. Mm-hmm. And it's about two girls set in basically 24th century Western Australia. It's a vaguely utopian setting and lots of things have been conquered. It's now perfectly normal there's no big struggle over being transgender or of a different sexuality or what have you. And it follows these two girls Sunati and Austin, who have this really sweet meet-cute moment at a station. And it sort of looks at disability and body image and this obviously sapphic romance as well. And, you know, it's vaguely sci-fi. One of the characters does end up going somewhere quite distant without any spoilers. If you're looking for really intense sort of action-packed plots, it's not that. It's not about that. This is a character study, and this is looking at some serious issues. For example, everybody sort of uses body mods, so they use a nanotechnology to change their appearance or change things about themselves. Body mods can be used for anything, for traveling, sort of living in deep colonies underwater, traveling through space. So there are good ways of shoring up the human body, but they're also used as fashion mods. So you might change your eyes to look cat-like, you might change your hair color, or to perfect your skin or whatever, or to even change your skin tone. And Austin has a disability whereby her body automatically rejects mods. So when she has to have a mod done for a health reason, it necessitates a sort of 4-week stay in hospital while they sort of, you know, take down her immune system low enough for her to be able to actually engage with the mod.
Yeah.
So she can't use fashion mods and things, and has quite a distorted perception of herself body-wise because of it. If you think in the future with these body mods, things like dieting and exercise is very optional. And dieting is a thing of the past because everyone can have the sort of ideal body they want. But this Egan syndrome, which rejects mods, affects a very small part of the population. And there's things like concentration mods that help you study for exams.
Ah, right.
Etc. So, you know, it's you know, everything is that much harder for her. So it's them negotiating this relationship. And obviously, Sunati's got things to overcome in herself as well, as in she's a bit of a people pleaser and isn't able to access her own anger very easily.
Right.
But it's really sweet. The art style is beautiful. Everything's very soft and pretty. And it's quite an easy read as well. So you can read it online, free on Webtoons. It's Ari North, Always Human, or you can wait until it comes out in paperback in June.
I do love me a soft sapphic romance. Sounds brilliant. Thanks very much, Jules. And for now, we'll say thanks very much for listening, guys. Hope everyone is keeping safe and well, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.